Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Gopijana Balabha Giravaridhari. Gopijana Balabha Giravaridhari. Yashoda Nandana Vraja Jana Ranjana. Yashoda Nandana Vraja Jana Ranjana. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Jai Om Vishnupad Paramahamsa Parvaja Gachara Sotera Sadashi Shimanis Divine Grace Asi Bhaktivedanta Swami Maharaj Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai Samaveda Bhaktivinoda Ki Jai Gaur Premananda. All glories to some of the devotees. All glories to some of the devotees. All glories to some of the devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Sri Gauranga. Namo Om Vishnupadaya Krishna Vastaya Buddhadaya Srimati Bhaktivedanta Swami Niti Namane. Namaste Saraswati Devam Gauravani Pacharni Nirvishesha Srinivadi Paskachadi Sitarane. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. We're reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 4, Chapter 29, the talks between Narada and King Prachinabarhi, text 56. Rajovacha Shrutam Anvikshitam Brahman Bhagavan Yadabhashata Naitajjanantyapadaya Himna Bruyur Vidur Yadi Rajovacha Shrutam Anvikshitam Brahman Bhagavan Yadabhasata Naitajjanantyapadhyaya Himna Bruyur Vidur Yadi Rajovacha Shrutam Anvikshitam Brahman Bhagavan Yadabhashita Naitajjanantyapadhyaya Kimna Bruyur Vidur Yadi. Others? Rajovacha. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato. Ladies. Najovacha. Rajovacha. The king said, Shrutam was heard, Anvikshitam was considered, Brahman, O Brahman, Bhagavan, the most powerful, yet which Abhashita you have spoken, na not, etat this, jananti, do know, upadhyaya, the teachers of fruitive activities, kim, why, nabruyu, they did not instruct, vidu, they understood, yadi, if. Translation purport by Srila Prabhupada. The king replied, my dear Brahman, whatever you said, I have heard with great attention, and considering all of it, have come to the conclusion that the acharyas, teachers, who engaged me in fruitive activities, did not know this confidential knowledge. If they were aware of it, why did they not explain it to me? Purport. Actually, the so-called teachers or leaders of material society do not really know the goal of life. They are described in the Bhagavad Gita as Mayaya Parita Jnana. They appear to be very learned scholars, but actually the influence of the illusory energy has taken away their knowledge. Real knowledge means searching out Krishna, Vedaischa Sarvaraham Eva Vedya. All Vedic knowledge is meant for searching out Krishna because Krishna is the origin of everything, Janmadisha Yata. It's from the first verse of the Srimad Bhagavatam. In Bhagavad Gita 10.2, Krishna says, Aham Adir Hi Devanam, I am the source of the demigods. Thus, Krishna is the origin and the beginning of all the demigods, including Lord Brahma, Lord Shiva, and all others. The Vedic ritualistic ceremonies are concerned with satisfying different demigods, but unless one is very advanced, he cannot understand that the original personality is Sri Krishna, Govindam Hari Purusham Tamaham Bachami. After hearing the instructions of Narada, King Barhishaman came to his senses. The real goal of life is to attain devotional service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The king therefore decided to reject the so-called priestly orders that simply engage their followers in the ritualistic ceremonies without giving effective instructions about the goal of life. At the present moment, the churches, temples, and mosques all over the world are not attracting people because foolish priests cannot elevate their followers to the platform of knowledge. Not being aware of the real goal of life, they simply keep their congregations in ignorance. Consequently, those who are well educated have become uninterested in ritualistic ceremonies, and at the same time, they are not benefited with real knowledge. This Krishna conscious movement is therefore very important for the enlightenment of all classes. Following the footsteps of Maharaj Barhishman, everyone should take advantage of this Krishna conscious movement and abandon the stereotype ritualistic ceremonies that go under the garb of so many religions. The Goswamis from the very beginning differed from the priestly class that was engaged in ritualistic ceremonies. Indeed, Srila Sanatana Goswami compiled his Hari Bhakta Vilas for the guidance of the Vaishnavas. The Vaishnavas, not caring for the lifelong activities of the priestly classes, take to full Krishna consciousness and become perfect in this very life. That is described in the previous verse as Paramahamsa Sharanam, taking shelter of the Paramahamsa, the liberated soul, and becoming successful in this life. Om Jnanatim Randasya Gnanjana Salakaya Chakshul Mitamina Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Vanchakalpa Thrivishcha Kribasinna Bevacha Paditano Pavane Bhyo Vaishnavi Vyo Namo Namaha. Hey Krishna. So I'm very happy to be here in Chicago again. I think I was here last year. And I actually joined Krishna Consciousness here in Chicago. Joined the Chicago Temple in 1972. So it's a very, very wonderful place, and many good memories. We, when I was here, we installed all Kishore Kishori and Lord Jagannath. I remember the temple president and I were laying the tile on the floor. This was in the old Evanston Temple on Emerson Street the night before. We used to do everything that way, sort of at the last minute, you know, building the temple like the day before the installation. But anyway, it was nice experience, and very, very nice to be back here with you all. Thank you. There's a very famous Prabhupada quote where he says, "Philosophy without religion is dry speculation, and religion without philosophy is simply sentimental." So our religions today are usually lacking one of these qualities. They are either don't really have true bhakti, or have devotion, or they may simply be very speculative. And or if they do have some pretense of devotion, they may lack philosophical depth and thus become just sentimental. So this is the difficulty, that we have very little true religion today, and that's what this verse in purport is talking about, where King Prachinabari has realized that all the instructions that he's been given by his priests and by his gurus and acharyas were actually simply on the materialistic platform. He had been instructed in Vedic rituals, sacrificial performance, and basically how to engage in fruitive work. Now, of course, you've just read for the last, I don't know how long, many, many verses of the wonderful instructions of Narada Muni, who has instructed him in a very different way and given him information on the real meaning of life, not based upon rituals or sacrifice or fruitive work to simply try to better oneself in this life or in the next lifetime, but to actually become self-realized, to understand the nature of the body, the nature of the soul, and the nature of one's relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So Narada, through so many different analogies and stories, allegories, instructed the king in this way about the entanglement of the material world and about how all of his fruitive activities simply led to more and more entrapment in the cycle of birth and death, and that the real goal of life was to give this up and to engage wholeheartedly, 100%, in the pure devotional service of Lord Sri Krishna. So now, after hearing all of this, the king is beginning to speak. And the first thing that he remarks is, he says, "I've been cheated. I've been misled all this time. Why was I not told this? This is true knowledge. This is enlivening. This is enlightenment. But nobody gave me this before." So that's the difficulty that we find ourselves in Kali Yuga. This dearth of knowledge, of real spiritual knowledge, is not there. So what Prabhupada is mentioning in this purport is that we have a real failure of religion to give real knowledge and to give satisfaction to the soul. And because of this failure to actually introduce true religious principles that are not only spiritually satisfying but also intellectually satisfying and give true knowledge, therefore we see the resultant rejection of spiritual life by the so-called intelligent class of people. And this is something very, very prominent, and we all have experienced in the Western world, that there are those people who are intelligent, the academic leaders or even some religious leaders like that, who have largely given up organized religion or formal religion and have very little use for it. Now, of course, part of it, you know, there's always two sides to it. The one side is, of course, their own failure to surrender, But the other side is that people have not been given the opportunity for real knowledge. And therefore, they tend to reject, you know, it's like the throwing out the baby with the bathwater idea. They tend to reject religion or reject spirituality, reject spiritual life, because everything that they have heard has not been very satisfying. And so many of the intellectual class of people have more or less rejected religion in the Western world. In fact, it seems like in many circles it's considered to be intelligent if you reject religion, isn't it? In other words, only like foolish or sentimental people accept religion or follow religious principles. But if you're really a little more enlightened, you're a little more with it, you know, you're a little sharper, you kind of see through that and you don't buy into that. Well, they simply have not heard the actual truth, and therefore they've come to this conclusion. And Prabhupada describes these people, of course, you know, who misuse their intelligence. They have knowledge, they have intelligence, but they misuse it as mayaya patrita jnana. Of course, this is described in the Bhagavad Gita of the four types of irreligious people, duskritanas, who do not surrender to Krishna. So Krishna explains, first, of course, he talks about the four pious people that surrender, but the four irreligious persons who will not surrender are the mudhas, the foolish people, Naradama, the lowest of mankind. These are people who are just basically in the lower modes of nature and just almost animalistic. The maya parita jnana, those whose knowledge is stolen by illusion, and the asuram bhavamashrita, those of atheistic nature, or nature of asuras or demons, people who are actually very envious of God and are actively rejecting and opposing the existence of God and God's position. But what we're sort of focusing now is this mayaya paritta jnana class, those who have some knowledge, but they have no depth of the real spiritual science of Krishna consciousness. And therefore, their knowledge that they have is very much limited to the interactions of the modes of nature. It's limited to knowledge of the material elements. Or sometimes there might be some quasi-spirituality or, you know, perhaps some understanding of subtle material principles. Because, of course, we have the gross elements, but we also have the subtle elements of mind, intelligence, and ego. So many of these people are very involved on the mind and the intelligence level, you know, where they may be academicians, or they may be scholars, or they may be even philosophers or religionists, you know, but as described here, they really do not understand the purpose of life. So this understanding of what is real, what is really knowledge, is in philosophy called epistemology. Epistemology simply means the study of knowledge and knowing. How do we know things? How do we know what's true? And of course, an intelligent person asks this. Prabhupada's Kunjan Madhya Yata, you know, and we can think of, you know, of course, that's one of the lines from the Vedanta Sutra, which also has Atato Brahma Jignasa. Now is the time for all intelligent persons to inquire into the absolute truth. So it's not that we, and Prabhupada often said, we do not advocate blind following. We advocate inquiry, intelligent inquiry. This is the purpose of human life, to try to understand who I am. What am I doing here? What is the purpose? What is my relationship with this material world? What is my relationship with God? An intelligent person asks these questions. But the problem is that how do we find the answers? And throughout at least the last couple hundred years of modern Western world, since probably what we call the Age of Enlightenment, which started in the mid-1700s. Now, it's kind of interesting that it was called the Age of Enlightenment, you know. So what they did was they were becoming enlightened from just belief in religion, and then they took to materialistic science. That was their idea of enlightenment. But at any rate, you know, since that time, knowledge has been pretty much dominated by rationalism and empiricism. Now, these are actually fairly simple terms, and they're talked about in the Vedas, and Srila Prabhupada talks about that. Rationalism and empiricism are also known as inductive and deductive knowledge. Inductive knowledge is called anuman, which is the study of logic, and prajaksha means direct perception or empirical knowledge. Prabhupada also described these as the ascending and well, it's an ascending and descending process. In one sense, is what with empirical knowledge is finding knowledge through the senses. What you do is you gather information and you come to a conclusion from that knowledge, where the opposite is where you start with a conclusion and logically build from that. So they kind of go in different directions. But as we'll see, they both have some severe defects in the system. Speaking of defects, we know that our problem as conditioned living entities in this material world is we have the four defects. We make mistakes. Our senses are imperfect. We have a tendency to cheat, and we're under illusion. In other words, we don't even know who we are. So much of this empiric knowledge, empiric method, which is also, remember this, you probably all remember when you were in school, they talked about the scientific method. You all had to learn sometime, probably about, I don't know where, around seventh grade or something, about the glories of the scientific method, how this was the way to really find knowledge if you follow the scientific method. Well, this is, as we know, is really not so scientific because there are so many problems with it. First of all, a lot of it is really bluffing. What they're saying is absolute knowledge changes all the time. By the time you're my age, what we learned in school has changed drastically to what people are learning now, and it was given to us with great assurance and authority that this is real knowledge. But yet, so many of those theories, you know, have changed over time. And then there's this cheating propensity. Sometimes we think, you know, well, is it? We might think maybe this is just some expression that Prabhupada uses. I mean, are the scientists all really cheating, consciously cheating? Well, they are, often. There's so much of this that goes on, particularly in the academic world. It started way back. Originally, I don't know, about 100 years ago, there was this hoax about the Piltdown Man, who was supposed to be the missing link in evolution. And they had these, you know, bones of this prehistoric man, and had exhibitions, and all the scientists studied it. And then a few years later, somebody revealed, actually, I just put those bones back in my farm in the backyard, and you know it was a complete hoax. And there's so many tendencies like this. One of the recent very embarrassing examples was there was this Korean scientist named Hwang, who was the one who was credited with cloning stem cells, and I think, you know, and remember the sheep and all of that. And it turned out it was a fraud. He had embezzled about $3 million in grant funds, and now which they're trying to get back, and he's been, you know, prosecuted and everything for fraud. His experiments weren't working, so he just made up the data. And this happens sometimes. You know, well, if I can't really prove what I want to prove, I'll make it look like I did. So, you know, how much can we put our faith in this type of process? You know, yeah. In fact, sometimes even the scientists even know that there's such, you know, and the academics are such fakes that they even make fun of themselves. There was a famous hoax by a scientist named Sokol, and he wrote this paper and published it in a journal. It's called Toward a Transformative Hermeneutics of Quantum Gravity. And he put this in such, you know, language that nobody could understand what he was really saying. Basically, what he was saying was the theory of gravity was really, it was a social and cultural sort of an imperialistic imposition on people to subdue, you know, people. In other words, you know, it was a complete joke. He was just writing this, you know, sort of to make fun of, and they actually published this, you know, in a journal. So in so many ways like this, you know, we see that this information is always changing. What might be true now may not be true, that people are cheating, making things up. At one time, people thought the earth was flat, and that was disproven. Of course, we have from the Srimad Bhagavatam thousands of years ago, we study the whole nature of the universe, of the planets as globes floating in space. This is all known in the Srimad Bhagavatam. It's not that we are rejecting scientific knowledge. We just want to get it right, you know, not all these concoctions, but to have true knowledge. Because Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita that he's giving Arjuna knowledge both nominal and phenomenal, material and spiritual. He says, by knowing which you shall know everything there is to be known. You know, there's so much, you know, talk, and most of us grew up, you know, with the idea of the atom and neutrons and protons. But you know, when subatomic particles were not even known until 1953, I mean, they act like they've known these things forever. Well, they haven't. And of course, they keep adding new ones. I don't even know what they all these new particles. But this is in the Bhagavatam. Bhagavatam is a whole chapter about, you know, about time and the movement of the atoms. And actually, subatomic particles are even mentioned in the Srimad Bhagavatam. So something that they came up with all their science in 1953, you know, the Vedic knowledge has been there for thousands and thousands of years. These things are known. So at any rate, we can see that our empiric knowledge is very limited, and the ability to try to, you know, just find out so much information through our limited senses and build that into some conception of truth is doomed for failure. Of course, the other main process of knowledge, of rationalism, rational argument and deduction, understanding through reason and logic. Now, that's probably gives example that, you know, logic means that you say all men are mortal, John is a man, therefore John is mortal. It's a logical proposition that follows. Now, of course, one of the problems with the logical argument is, what if your first axiom, your first proposition is not correct? If we say all men are mortal, what if that's wrong? Then, of course, everything we build from that is true. And can we prove that all men are mortal? You know, because we haven't had experience of every single person ever born, whoever will be born, and be able to actually see that they're all mortal. But of course, from the Vedic literatures, we could understand that very easily and accept that. But that's a different thing. Now, there is a proper use of logic and argument. It should be used, and the rational mind is there. Krishna has given that for a reason. And in fact, some scriptures called Nyaya Prasthana are based upon logic. Like Vedanta Sutra is one of those. It's given an example of a Vedic literature which largely uses logic and reason, building, you know, propositions, building sort of a case. So that can be done if it's done properly. But there's so many problems, because we can argue so many things one way or the other, and do we really obtain truth? I remember when I was on the debate team in high school, there was an idea or there was a problem, and you'd take one side or the other. You'd be for or you'd be against it. You know, like, didn't really matter, you know, whether you were the pros or the cons, you know, the positive or I forget what they call them, but, you know, one side or the other, you know, it was just like an exercise in debate, you know. And of course, Prabhupada gives the example of the Munis, in India, they're called Munis. In other words, they have to have a new idea all the time, something, way of juggling words in such a way that they can defeat others or come up with a different idea. And of course, Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu exhibited this himself, you know, during his days when he was a young scholar in Avadweep. You know, he was such a great logician that he could take an argument and defeat everybody, then he could turn around and take the other side and defeat everybody. You know, so he kind of gave this example that, yeah, well, through logic and argument, you can prove anything. There's a famous philosopher named Immanuel Kant, and Kant came up with what we call these antimonies. Antimonies were logical arguments that he would build for and against things. So Kant, who was actually somewhat spiritual himself, and he actually believed in God, but he would, to show sort of the how this works, he would build a logical argument for the existence of God, or for causation, or for the existence of space and time, or anything like this. And it would be this completely tight argument that was almost undefeatable. Then he'd turn around and do the argument for the opposite. You know, Kant was even showing hundreds of years ago that, you know, you can argue things one way or the other, and you probably are not going to get at the absolute truth. This is not the way to actually understand anything of spiritual life. Of course, for one thing, the scientists and the materialistic philosophers, they sort of like, you know, they stack the deck. You know, they put it in such a way, like if you ask a question that's philosophical or theological, they'll say, well, we don't go there. That doesn't count. You know, that's not what we study. We're only studying what we can actually know scientifically. You know, so if you want to talk about religion or God, well, that's something else. That's over here. We won't really talk about that. So they conveniently avoid any higher topics. And they avoid facing the fact that they actually cannot understand any final causation. They talk about how things happen, but it's within a very limited sphere. They're talking about how the material energy is acting and reacting and interacting. But if you ask, how did the material energy come about, who has it in control of the material energy, they don't know. They give theories of the Big Bang, but if you ask, you know, that these ingredients came together, exploded, and life was formed, that's a simplistic explanation, of course. But, you know, if you ask them, where did these ingredients come from? Who supplied the energy? They can't answer. You know, so again and again, we see that their arguments and their propositions are so limited that they're not satisfying to people. And because these are not satisfying, people more or less give up hope. You know, people decide that there really isn't anything that's true. Why should I believe any of this? And of course, they give up ideas of religion along with it. So the results of these sort of materialistic philosophies, what are they? Well, we can see what happens. All we have to do is look around us in Kali Yuga in this modern materialistic world, and we see the result of this lack of spiritual faith and spiritual knowledge and the embracing of a materialistic concept of life. First of all, many people feel that there are no absolutes. You can't. One thing is good as another. I teach courses in universities, and I teach courses in ethics and psychology of knowledge and learning, things like this. And I find the students consistently express this. You know, like they think that it's very modern and that they're becoming enlightened by thinking that everything is equal, right? In other words, your idea is as good as my idea, you know, and so there tends to be this rejection of anything absolute. This is a part of what we call postmodernism. Modernity or modernism basically was an idea of, you know, from, you know, the 50s and the 60s. When you think about how the culture was, the idea was, well, everything is going well, everything has a purpose, we're getting better and better, we're learning more and more, we have prosperity, economic growth, and, you know, things just will continue to get better, and we'll have a good way of life. Well, you know, that idea kind of crashed at a certain point after a few wars, social unrest, and like that, and postmodernism arose. And postmodernism basically is saying there really are no absolutes. Everyone has to more or less figure it out for themselves. You have to find your own meaning. You have to see what's good for you or what's important for you. And we have to really reject, you know, all these old established, you know, paradigms that our parents may have had or our religion has taught us like that. Now, and so what is the result? Well, if there are no absolutes, then what is to prevent you from doing anything? I mean, it becomes a very self-centered type of philosophy, because ultimately, if I have to determine what is true and what I feel is the absolute truth is as good as what anyone else in the entire history of the universe has ever thought, that puts me in a pretty good position, doesn't it? It's almost like, oh, maybe I'm God. You know, it's like, practically speaking. And therefore, whatever one believes, whatever one does for one's own enjoyment or one's own sense of whatever is right and wrong, is as good as anyone else's. So there's no check on exploiting people or animals or the earth. A purpose of life basically becomes sense gratification, whatever is pleasing to one. Why not? So there's no real meaning, you know, just do whatever you want. That will feel good. And therefore, you know, if things are like inconvenient, like children, well, sure, we'll have abortions. People in our way will have wars. You know, and we see that so many things come from this. Now, of course, the other side to this, there's always two sides to everything. And I was talking about this once, and some devotee pointed, who's studying philosophy, pointed out to me, says, well, you know, there is an advantage of postmodernism. And this, that because people have rejected so many things, they're ripe for finding out what is really true. So in other words, because there is a lot of rejection of traditional values and traditional belief systems, and it's not satisfying, people are ready to actually hear something higher. They're actually ready to hear the truth, to hear something that makes sense, that can fill that void in their life. Because this advance, you know, this material advancement, and you know, and these types of philosophies do not lead to happiness. People are progressively more confused and more unhappy, more stressed, you know, than ever before. And now we see that, in fact, this is a symptom of Kali Yuga. It's not always that people are so much distressed by you know, outside events, natural catastrophes, illness. Like, of course, that's all there too. We see that happening every day. But people are very, very mentally distressed. This is very much of a Kali Yuga symptom, that there's so much anxiety, so much mental stress that's there. I saw some figures from the National Institute of Mental Health said that in America, 48% of the entire population will suffer a major mental disorder sometime in their lifetime. Half the people. Practically speaking, half the people will have some major mental disorder. And in any given year, about 26% of the population suffers some type of psychological or emotional issue. Very, very common. And again, this is Kali Yuga, that we find that there's such anxiety and there's such stress that's there that people are very unhappy. I think it's interesting that when I was young, many, many years ago, like maybe 40, 50 years ago, they used to talk about social problems that we're going to face in the future. And one of them that they used to talk about is, you know, with all of this modern scientific advancement, all the labor-saving devices that we're creating, you know, like washing machines. No, I'm not quite that old, but they had washing machines when I was a kid. But we had running water and the whole bit. But they said, what will people do with all the leisure time? You know, that was supposed to be a major social problem because people won't have much to do. We have all this, you know, scientific advancements doing all the work. And so, you know, people have to find something to do with themselves. Has that happened? I kind of keep waiting for that. When is this leisure time going to happen? No, it's, in fact, we find that people are working harder than ever. People are having great difficulty economically, even supporting a family. We just saw a major economic, you know, recession. We saw so many things happening. And, you know, this hasn't come to pass at all. In fact, if anything, we could say that the stress level, the anxiety, and the difficulties that people are facing now are probably greater than ever. You know, it's in some ways they talk about economic growth like that, but the reality is that in terms of actual quality of life, most people are much farther behind than they were. You know, and I would say even a generation or two ago, most of us can remember of my age that it wasn't so difficult to pay the rent or to buy a house or do these sort of things. Now, these, of course, are not the purpose of life, but they are indicators that what they're doing is not working well. They're striving for material prosperity and material happiness, and they're practically getting the opposite. It's really not working. And many people are starting to understand that and see that and kind of wake up to that. You know, but the problem is, what is the solution? What is the alternative? And the modern leaders are not really giving good solutions. The politicians, you know, basically give sound bites. You know, that a little something that will, you know, in fact, they don't even want to propose something until they do, you know, they do a little sample poll on it and they do a focus group and see how people are going to accept it. Well, what if I say this? Will people like that? No, 53% of the people didn't think that was a good idea. So I'll come up with something else that 60% of people will think is a good idea. This isn't leadership. This isn't, you know, this is not leading people to what needs to be done in life. And there's no leadership from our scientists and from our academic community and from our religious leaders for the most part. So nobody's really feeling this, you know, that there's, which is, it's interesting because everybody wants to, you know, make up their own idea, have their own opinion, but at the same time they're looking for leadership. Why? Because they really don't know. Because nobody knows in this material world. Everyone is bewildered. Everyone is under illusion. And therefore, everyone is suffering. This is something that they can't get around. If you really, you know, if you talk to people, and, you know, if they, no matter how much they may protest that their life is good or everything is there, nobody can deny that ultimately there's suffering in this material world. Nobody can deny birth, death, disease, and old age. These are integral parts of our life within this material world, within these material bodies. Therefore, we need to find a real solution. And that's what Srila Prabhupada has told us over and over again. You can hear in practically every page of the Srimad Bhagavatam and every lecture, try to find a solution to the real problems of life. How to get out of this material world, how to get out of this condition of suffering, and take up our real position, our real life, as spirit souls in relationship with God, who have a natural, loving relationship with God, And all we need to do is revive that dormant relationship with God. Prabhupada would always say, we are not imposing something artificial on the soul. This is the natural position of the soul, our Sarup Dharma, our Sanatana Dharma, our Sarup, our natural position, is to love God and have a relationship of love and service. But then as soon as you say service, then you lose a few people, don't you? Because we, the way that we have been raised and the way that we think, particularly in the West, we're very self-indulgent. Me, serve? People should be serving me. You know, I want to be in control. I want to be the Lord, the master of all I survey. You know. But people, if they're a little bit intelligent, they can understand the principle that everyone is serving. There's no getting away from it. We're serving our families, we're serving our boss at work, we're serving our country, we're serving our senses, if nothing else. We're serving this body to keep it alive and to keep it happy. So the principle of service is universal. That's part of our eternal nature. That's our constitutional position. But where do we repose that service is the question. So we're very fortunate that we have these wonderful pastimes, stories, and preaching from the Srimad Bhagavatam, as Narada Muni is telling us the real purpose, telling us how to get out of this ignorance that we find ourselves in, and how to find our real purpose of life and our real position. Once the living entity finds that, then they can be happy. Otherwise, there's only going to be unhappiness in this material world. There's an interesting verse in the Srimad Bhagavatam that I found when I was kind of looking this class over. It's one of those where, like, oh, you say, oh, I forgot that was even in the Bhagavatam. I don't remember this one. You know, it happens all the time to me, at least, you know, that we find these little gems in the Bhagavatam every time that we pick it up and read it. This is from 7.15.12. It says, it's kind of related to this idea of cheating religions or those who cannot give real knowledge. It says, there are five branches of irreligion, appropriately known as irreligion, vidharma, religious principles for which one is unfit, paradharma, pretentious religion, abhasa, analogical religion, upadharma, and cheating religion, chaladharma. One who is aware of real religious life must abandon these five as irreligious. So apparently these different types of cheating religions have been with us forever. And the Bhagavatam talks about, even enumerates the different types of that are out there that we have to be aware of. Now, I don't really know these very well, and unfortunately, Srila Prabhupada in his purport doesn't discuss them specifically as far as what these five mean, but I think we can get the idea somewhat. But Prabhupada does in his purport give us a really nice synopsis, where he says, any religious principles opposed to the principle of surrendering to the lotus feet of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, are to be considered religious principles of irregularity or cheating, and one who is actually interested in religion must give them up. One should simply follow the instructions of Krishna and surrender unto him. To do this, of course, one needs very good intelligence, which may be awakened after many, many births through good association with devotees and the practice of Krishna consciousness. Everything but the principle of religion recommended by Krishna, sarva-dharmam parityaja mamekam sharanam vraja, should be given up as irreligion. So we always come down to this final word of the Bhagavad Gita, again and again, sarva-dharmam parityaja mamekam sharanam vraja, you know, that we don't really need these different philosophies, these different religions, these different ways of trying to understand the world that are simply cheating, that are going to lead us astray, because they are not leading us to the central purpose of life, which is surrender to Krishna. So Krishna himself says his conclusion to Arjuna after speaking so much philosophy, don't worry about all these different types of religious principles or different ideas, simply surrender. So, of course, that's a very simple, easy thing to say, sometimes a little more difficult to actually accomplish, isn't it? You know, so the surrendering process is, unfortunately for most of us, it's not a one-time thing, okay, I surrender, then that's it. I've always found it interesting that in the Srimad Bhagavatam, we find that so many great personalities are there. They have some epiphany, they have some realization, they have some moment when a great soul comes into their life, enlightens them. Then they become great pure devotees. Even Magrari the hunter, right? I mean, he became a great devotee after Narada Muni, you know, enlightened him and showed him the truth. Even very, very fallen people. In Kali Yuga, it seems like it's a little more difficult, isn't it? You know, you think, okay, I got the Srimad Bhagavatam. I heard the words of Srila Prabhupada. I should be enlightened now, you know. But it seems like it's more of a struggle for us. It's more of a process. And, of course, that process is the process of sadhana bhakti. That's all there. Krishna knows that it's difficult for us in Kali Yuga, and so Krishna sends his representatives, he sends his instructions, and so the acharyas and the gurus have given us the path of devotional service, of how we can become enlightened. And it may take some time, it may be a gradual path, but as we take up the process of hearing and chanting the holy names, it becomes easy in one sense. So as we've heard many times, Kali Yuga is a very unfortunate age. It's very difficult for us to make spiritual advancement, but we have the great fortune of the Harinam Sankirtan, of the holy name, making this a very simple process, even for those of us who are not so qualified in this age of Kali. So it takes some faith. We simply have to have faith in the words of our guru, the words of Srila Prabhupada, and the words of the Srimad Bhagavatam. And based upon that faith, holding to these principles of religion and taking up the practice, very soon so many misgivings are taken away and our mind becomes much more peaceful and calm, and we can actually understand this is real spiritual life. This is what is giving me life and hope and happiness. And when we have that personal experience, then naturally we want to give that experience to others. We want others to also have this and experience what we have received. It's natural. It's part of our natural gratitude. Now, we may not have so much gratitude, but as we become purified, that's one of the good qualities of devotees, of gratitude, arises within the heart. And then one just naturally, it's not that you have to, of course, I remember in the beginning, sometimes it's a matter of someone pushing you out of the van out on Sankirtan to go distribute the mercy. But as we advance a little bit, it becomes a more and more of just a natural feeling, a natural process of wanting to give the same wonderful gift of spiritual life and Krishna consciousness that we receive to others. And the devotees are there everywhere. So many of you have experienced to go out and preach and experience that. I was, the day before yesterday, I've almost lost track of time. I flew to Birmingham, Alabama from Florida on Saturday, and flew back on Sunday, and flew to Chicago on Monday. But we did a program, a Janmashtami program in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. And I was telling one of my godbrothers about this program I was going to do, and he said, Tuscaloosa, Alabama. Are there devotees there? Yes, there are devotees in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, and in Birmingham, Alabama, and in Columbia, Mississippi, and all sorts of very, very interesting, far out of the way places like that. The devotees are everywhere, and we just need to take Lord Chaitanya's Sankirtan party there to somehow pick them up, as Prabhupada said. You know, that's all we really need to do is somehow be there and be a presence, and devotees are out there waiting for this priceless spiritual knowledge. So I don't know how long I'm supposed to go on for, but I feel like that's enough. Is there any other comments, questions? Someone has some? No, we have a few here. Okay, let's take one here, then one in the back, and then the lady in the back. Okay. Go ahead. I think you have to speak up. Do we have a microphone or not? Oh, maybe you can go ahead, Mom. Yeah, the types of Vedic evidence. Yeah.
To know the reality, because it may not be able to succeed.
So if I understood you, I think your question was that there's these different ways of knowing, of inductive, deductive, and Shabda Brahman, hearing from authority. How do we use all those as devotees? Was that it? How to use our intelligence to... I'm not sure if I'm quite understanding the question. You're saying, how do we use these different types of evidence?
How can you depend upon these three things to know that anything?
Oh. Well, of course, we want to use everything in Krishna's service, including our intelligence. I think that was one of the points that you were making, and we have these abilities, these intellectual cognitive abilities, and so certainly we use them. Just like I gave the example that the Vedanta Sutra uses logic primarily. And to establish the absolute truth, to establish spiritual life. So it can be done in that way. And, you know, as far as, empiric evidence, we obviously just, we use that all the time in Krishna's service to be able to manipulate things in the material energy and the idea of yukta vairagya, of using everything in Krishna's service. So sometimes we have to figure things out. We have to learn how to do things. And, so I don't know if I'm exactly answering your question, but the idea is that, devotee uses everything. We use our minds, we use our intelligence, the idea is we use it to serve Krishna. But ultimately, our proof, our understanding of God's existence comes from descending knowledge, from Shabda, from hearing from the spiritual master and from hearing from the Shastra. Now, of course, the question we ask, how does the intelligent mind simply accept something on faith? Well, it isn't just on faith. It's on faith that is also backed up by logic and reason and is also strengthened by experience. I think that all of us coming... I'm probably diverging a little from your question, but I think all of us, when we coming to Krishna consciousness, at some point we had some experience, some realization that confirmed the philosophy to us. All right, I don't think we'd be here otherwise. There's so many ideas, so many places we could go. There's places that have a lot easier principles to follow. So in other words, it takes some commitment, to take up this path. So there also has to be that realization within the heart, that corresponds and confirms our reason and our logic. And that comes about, through service, And as the more we engage in the process of sadhana, the more it becomes clear and the more our faith becomes stronger. Yeah. I'll take a couple of others. Was someone else in the back? Or? Okay, go ahead.
My question was, at the beginning of the class, you were speaking about the importance of inquiry and the absolute. And I was thinking of devotees, we do our study and we do our services, we do all those things. But I'm just thinking personally, I feel like all those things may still not get us to worship in the sense that I feel like there's something else that has to be done in conjunction with the study and all those different things internally, perhaps, that is going to get us that goal of life. So I was just wondering, what is that thing? Because sometimes I feel like you can take shelter in the fact that you have read someone's books on Christian philosophy, and if you have a few arguments, and I know what is the science. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, there's jnana and vijnana. You know, jnana is knowledge. Vijnana means realized knowledge. And so we have to take knowledge, you know, which is theoretical knowledge, to the practical, to the realized position. And that's where, as you were saying, I think you're pretty close here. I think you understand it yourself. But you know, is the practical devotional service is what will give us the realization. Knowledge in itself is not sufficient. In fact, it's described that knowledge and detachment are concomitant byproducts of bhakti. So the most important thing is bhakti, is devotion. Knowledge will arise from that, and detachment from the material world will arise from that. So we actually don't need a specific amount of intellectual knowledge. However, to come to the point of bhakti, we have to have enough sufficient knowledge to be able to do that. In other words, without knowledge, we're not very likely to just walk in one day to surrender to Krishna, serve Krishna very nicely, chant Krishna's holy name, and say, "I have absolutely no idea why I'm doing this, but you know, I like it." You know, it's some people maybe, but that's, you know, not so common. So in other words, we need the cultivation of knowledge to bring us to the point of bhakti, and then further knowledge and renunciation, detachment come as the result of bhakti. So then it becomes sort of a spiraling thing, you know. It works together, you know, and that true realization does come about, you know, as we progress in devotional service. That's something that we all experience. You know, you experience the gradual development of true realization, which will confirm the sort of intellectualized knowledge that we may have in the beginning. Okay. Go ahead. Okay, I didn't hear. There's something about the echo in this room without the speakers. It's in my hearing, it's not so good. But basically, you're talking about people who it's hard to reach them. They're not likely to accept the philosophy of Krishna consciousness. And, you know, of course, I think you mentioned giving prasadam and like that. And sometimes that's the best thing that you can do. You know, if we're. What's that? Oh, they don't respect. Well, doesn't matter. Let them have their beer along with their prasadam, as long as they're taking the prasadam. I'll give you a quick story about something like that. It was 1976. Srila Prabhupada was visiting Potomac when I was at the temple there, and it was the bicentennial of the United States, 1776 to 1976. So they're having a huge fireworks exhibit display down at the mall, the Capitol, and Srila Prabhupada wanted to go. We were thought, oh, that sounds exciting. So we all jumped in the cars and our vans, and we were driving this procession along with Srila Prabhupada, and it was very, very crowded. You know, millions of people were there, and I don't know if you know the George Washington Parkway. You know, it's kind of up over the river, and a lot of people were, thousands of people were all parked along there, and they were just like hanging out, you know, to wait for the fireworks. And, you know, a lot of them were young people, were drinking, et cetera, and, you know, and getting, you know. And the traffic was very slow. And our first, we had Prabhupada was in a car, and behind there was a big van full of brahmacharis and having a big kirtan going on. And a lot of the people were listening and chanting, and a lot of them were even kind of like mocking or making fun of it or chanting along. And after we got, by the way, we saw the fireworks started, a couple went off. Prabhupada said, "That's enough." He wasn't that interested. But so we went all the way back. But Prabhupada remarked later, he says, "The best part," he says, "were those young people chanting." He said, "It doesn't matter even if they were making fun." He said they gain spiritual advancement by hearing the kirtan party and by participating and by chanting. You know, so that's agata sakriti, of course, unknowing benefit. If somebody contacts Krishna consciousness in some way, whether they're conscious or unconscious of that, they gain that spiritual benefit. And in fact, it's described that that's one of the ways that we come to Krishna consciousness is through the accumulation of agata sakriti. Because we know in the beginning there must be shraddha, faith. And so the question is asked, how does that faith originally come? And our acharyas have described that it's through the accumulation of agata sakriti, you know, of having some connection with Krishna consciousness in past lifetimes that gives us sufficient faith to associate with devotees and take up the practice. So any way you can engage people, don't worry about if they're accepting it the right way or the wrong way in the beginning. As they become purified little by little, you know, that will change. And then, of course, the other thing is we don't always reach everybody, at least right away. It may take time, may take another lifetime, you know. You know, Srila Prabhupada gave the example of the rain is coming down and it rains, you know, on fertile fields. It also rains on the ocean and on dry rocks where it doesn't do any good. But the rain is there for everyone, but it's the matter of the receptivity, you know, and whether they can take advantage or not. Okay. Okay. Prabhu? Okay.
The postmodern, you were describing that kind of attitude of the postmodern.
Yeah. Yeah, and this is always a problem with people because there again it comes to the idea that, you know, we all sort of make our own decisions and my way is as good as anybody else's you know, there's this idea of cultural relativity and everything is more or less the same and one is as good as another, and so why impose one way or your way on, you know, yeah, I might like your ideas and philosophy. You know, of course, in the beginning we don't impose that so much. I mean, that's the simple answer. I mean, Srila Prabhupada would often say, you know, you don't have to impose anything artificially. Just add to your life. Prabhupada would always say, just add the chanting the holy name, add the Hare Krishna, add reading these books to your life. You know, they don't have to dress in a dhoti, you know, like, you know, right away or anything. But as far as devotees who are a little bit more realized or a little more dedicated or, you know, become a little more farther along in the process, we realize that we do these things for the pleasure of Krishna and the Guru, ultimately. You know, it's not our idea, but, you know, we decide what's fashionable this year. It's, you know, what's pleasing to Krishna. And so those things that are part of the body become less important. And the other thing about our simple way of dress and lifestyle and like that is it simplifies our life. There's less concern about all these material aspects, you know. So, you know, one time one reporter asked Srila Prabhupada, says, why do you shave your head? And he said, it's very clean. You know, I mean, you know, it's just one of those real simple answers, you know. Didn't have to give an elaborate philosophical, you know, reason. But, you know, it's just, but, you know, in one sense, I think he didn't want to get into it a whole lot with him. But at the same time, he was just saying that, you know, these are just sort of like simple principles of cleanliness and simplicity of how we conduct ourselves. But ultimately, it's for the pleasure of Krishna. Okay. Jai. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.
Very nice in the room, except for the internet.